should enter the forest, whereas a purified Brahmana should accept the renounced order of life. One who has not surrendered to me should move progressively from one ashram to another, never acting otherwise. Purport. Those who are not surrendered devotees of the Lord must rigidly observe the regulations governing one's authorized social status. There are four social divisions of life, namely brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. One who wants to fulfill material desires should become an ordinary householder, grihastha, establish a comfortable residence, and maintain his family. One desiring to accelerate the process of purification may give up his home and business and live in a sacred place with his wife, as indicated here by the word vanam, or forest. There are many sacred forests in India meant for this purpose, such as Vrindavan and Mayapur. The word dvijottama indicates the brahmanas. Brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas are all dvija, or initiated in the Gayatri mantra, but the brahmana is dvijottama, or the highest among those who have received second birth by spiritual initiation. It is recommended that a purified Brahman take to the renounced order of life, sannyas, giving up further contact with the so-called wife. The Brahmana is specifically mentioned here since kshatriyas and vaishyas are not to take the renounced order of life. Even so, there are many stories in the Bhagavatam wherein great kings retire with their aristocratic wives to the forest to practice the austerities of vanaprast and thus accelerate the process of purification. The Brahmanas, however, may directly accept the renounced order of life. The words ashramat, ashramam, gachet indicate that one may progressively move from brahmacharya life to grihastha life to vanaprastha life and then to sannyas. The words ashramat, ashramam emphasize that one should never remain without an authorized social status, nor should one go backward, falling down from a higher position. Those who are not surrendered devotees of the Lord must rigidly observe such injunctions, for otherwise they will quickly become degraded and their sins will place them outside the bounds of authorized human civilization. Lord Krishna emphasizes here that a non-devotee must rigidly observe the rituals and regulations of Vedic social divisions, whereas the Lord's pure devotee, engaged 24 hours a day in Lord Krishna's mission, is transcendental to such divisions. If, however, one performs illicit activities on the strength of being transcendental to Vedic social divisions, one is revealed to be a materialistic neophyte and not an advanced devotee of the Lord. An advanced devotee who remains aloof from material sense gratification is not bound by the Vedic social divisions. Thus, even a householder may live very austerely, traveling and preaching Krishna consciousness away from home, and even a sannyasi may sometimes engage women in the devotional service of Lord Krishna. The most advanced devotees cannot be restricted by the rituals and regulations of the Varnashram system, and they move freely around the world distributing love of Godhead. Matpara indicates a pure devotee of the Lord who always keeps the Lord fixed in his heart and consciousness. One who falls down to become a victim of sense gratification is not fully established on the platform of Matpara and should rigidly observe the social divisions and regulations to remain steady on the platform of pious human life. So we're discussing, actually this is a more discrete definition of the different social divisions, and it's very much needed for us to become in great understanding of these different divisions. I think Nagaraj was giving a class the other day. It was like a blast from the past or ISKCON a long time ago when we really didn't have a social a society, really. It was just a lot of volunteers. And if you actually volunteered to accept, you know, the Krishna consciousness, then you were daily pinned on a badge that whatever was needed, that's what you were. That's what you did. So if someone was new, you put on a badge and said, okay, now you're the temple president, or you're the book distributor, or you're this, or you're that. And every day it might even change. So there was no clarification of what everyone was according to their qualifications and characters. But we did the needful to spread this movement, and this was what he reminded us of. It was the Hare Krishna explosion. Not that it isn't exploding now, but it was exploding in a more chaotic way that in those days, by hook or crook, we were spreading the movement. But we gained so much from that by doing that. We learned a lot about submissiveness, you know, what it really means to be told what to do, you know, and to do things selflessly, just doing because you, Prabhupada wanted this done. Something that I think is a very valuable part of my Krishna consciousness, and I think anyone who experienced it was something that you really took to heart and has helped you throughout your Krishna conscious career. Actually, as it's said here, it's a progression that we go from one step to the other. Ultimately, the Vedic culture is meant to bring you back to Krishna. So at the time of death, you can be totally absorbed in Krishna and nothing else is there that makes any difference. So Krishna is very glad to accept you back. He has open arms for those who really want to be with him and don't have any more attachments to this material world at all, which is it's a hard thing to do. So things back then were a little bit topsy-turvy. Here it's described how you brahmacharya, then you go and you can get married, and then after you get married, you can start renouncing. In those days, we were brahmacharya, brahmacharini, most everybody. And then if you happened to get married, you immediately were vanaprast. You were lived in the temple together, and you did everything separately, or else you were sent to a temple, and you were too busy to think about family life, and you were actually vanaprast. And so then the temples kind of changed at some point, and all those people had to go and become a grihastha again. They had to go from vanaprastha back to grihastha. I had to get a job. I had to take care of my family, put my family all back to pieces, and so it was a little crazy. But now we're slowed down, and we have to be more thoughtful and more organizing of our society, so that we can make this progression and not go backwards, not go forwards, jump around, but actually go towards our goal. Because we are trying to make this a society that an example for the whole world to follow. Now we can look around. The brahmachari ashram has thinned out such that it's not quite visible even in this room. And the grihastha has swollen. The grihastha ashram has swollen to leaps and bounds. And as you can tell by the over 100 kids in the school and more being born every single day, which is nice, making a lot of nice devotees. And then there's a little trickle of vanaprastha now. It's a little few little trickles going out. And then we have some sannyasis that are doing a very nice service for the movement. But for the grihastha, you know, that's a big percentage of your lifetime. And it's a whole balancing act of keeping your material and spiritual life together. And as we've all found out, it's not real easy. And it's a challenge. But it's very important that these grihasthas take advantage of the other persons who are more advanced and more detached from the vanaprastha, from the brahmacharis, from all the other social orders. We see that when such a saint as, what's his name? Marshana Maharaj coming. Then I'm sure people are already asking him to come to their home so they can hear from them, so they can feed the sannyasi or the advanced devotee and hear. We hear of Narada Muni would only stay long enough to milk a cow. I guess they try to stretch a little longer so that they could get more nectar from him. But yes, the grihasthas are always looking for some opportunity to hear and to beg, borrow, or steal, but to get the nectar of the holy name. Because no matter what ashram you are in, that we are surviving because we have this mercy of the holy name, which gives us the strength to continue and to progress in no matter what position where we are. So this is something that's very valuable and that we should figure out whatever ashram we're in, how we can become so absorbed in the holy name, which is our saving grace. So then we see that the brahmachari life normally is that one will be a celibate student. We were hearing from Chaturatma, I think, about how at a very young age you would go to the householder's home and stay there and learn to become very austere and renounced and very very full of the knowledge of Krishna consciousness. And then at some point you're given an option. The celibate student could decide, usually when they're, I guess, like in the 20s or something like that, after being trained for so long, then they could take to householder life, get married, or else they could stay and go straight to a more renounced lifetime of actually remaining celibate and just concentrating in your spiritual life and ultimately taking sannyas, which is a renounced order with no association with women, and going back home, back to Godhead. But that's a hard road to follow, and not many do. So most people, the brahmacharis, they actually ask the guru or some advice from some sadhus on how they should plan to get married. And after such a wonderful training, then they have that strength to balance it nicely the rest of their life. So this is an option that one may have. And then when you become a householder, then, of course, you take shelter of the holy name and devotional service and raise your family in a Krishna conscious way. And then, meanwhile, you're formulating a plan with your wife of how you can start disentangling yourself. This is after the kids are grown up, and 50, or Prabhupada says a little more than 50 is okay. But this is something that we should take to heart, all of us who are over 50, over 60, over 70. Anyway, that we should start disentangling ourselves and becoming more fixed in our Krishna consciousness. So that plan is there. You can become detached even with your wife and travel and preach. Prabhupada really liked it when they would become teachers in ashrams or in schools. They would go out and preach. And no sexual entanglement whatsoever, but just fixed in spreading the Krishna conscious movement. Many vanapras, he said, go to these holy places like Mayapur, Vrindavan, which they do have some facility now, to help with the deity worship. Instead of so many brahmacharis being here doing that, we find that many of the vanapras are coming back in volunteering services to do different things on the altar, which is very nice, very very fixing in the mind. So this is a natural progression that one will continue to be fired up in Krishna consciousness by doing something that is throwing them forward and in their spiritual progress. So The more advanced you become, even as a vanapras, then you would actually have this opportunity to become sannyas and cut yourself away from the entanglement altogether. And this is now in ISKCON. This is not a whimsical thing. One can't just decide themselves to become sannyas, all of a sudden just change your clothes overnight and wave goodbye to your wife. But no, this is there's actually a whole division where one gets trained and has to take courses, and you're run through the rake, I guess you'd say, and you actually have to, submit yourself amongst some very advanced Vaishnavas to see that if actually you're qualified. So it's not a whimsical thing. You actually have to become qualified to become sannyas. So we do find that those people are in our movement, which are very nice. There's different orders of sannyas, too, and that's also a progression. So when one would leave their wife and home and everything, sometimes they would just go outside the city limits or a little way from your village and get a cottage. And then, for the food would come from home. Someone would bring it and leave it there. And this is called kudichak. This is the first stage of sannyas. And then there's another stage where you would become even more dependent, because sannyas means actually become fully dependent on Krishna. So as you progress, then you would not depend on anything from home anymore at all. You would actually leave home with very, very few possessions, and you would have to go beg for your food. And this is, I can't imagine doing that. Can anyone here imagine doing that? to have to just depend on going to someone else's home and asking them for food. Would be very humbling, that's for sure. And you might get pretty hungry, too. Unless you have a really big community of devotees around. So that's called bahudak. And then from that, becoming even more dependent, one would just put all their possessions in a little teeny bag that you carry on your shoulder, and you would travel and preach. You would go from door to door, or from county to county. And then, of course, now you have to be a pretty charismatic person or have a lot of money to be able to travel to different countries, have them invite you and pay for your way to come and enlighten them. And so many devotees are doing that. It's really wonderful. And like she was saying here, even if we can just go to another temple and preach, it's such a nice thing. I've done it before. It's just really enlivening to go to a whole community and to be appreciated, you know, that you got something that maybe you could give to other devotees that don't get to hear from senior devotees. So it's a very nice occupation. I highly recommend doing it. And of course, this is the Parvachakacharya, one who actually just travels and preaches, and the world is the limit. You know, you go anywhere in the world and preach. And for us, Srila Prabhupada took up that order, and he took it up very seriously and came here to America and started a worldwide organization of Krishna consciousness, which we are indebted totally. Our whole life is indebted to serving his mission. And then the last stage of sannyas is paramahamsa. And those are for those people who want to totally cut themselves off from material anything. And they would go and they would sit down and read and chant and maybe write and really just absorb themselves in just those things that are going to be healthy for their spiritual life. And they abandon any other association with materialistic persons and activities. And so this is for the pure devotee, one who actually has no more desire for any sensual pleasure. I don't know who categorizes themselves in that area, but that's a hard order, to not have any desire for anything sensual. And that's the Paramahansa stage. So this is the progression. And in each position, there's a check and balance system. You live with like-minded devotees. It's an ashram. Ashram means protection. It's a shelter. And as it's discussed here, you have to be in a shelter of some sort in spiritual life. Out there, if you're not sheltered, you're going to be bombarded. You're going to be beat up and thrown around. Because material energy, that's her nature, is to beat you up. So you have to remain in a shelter. If not, you're putting yourself in a very precarious situation. It's not healthy. So one should be very careful to bunker themselves down in some ashram and be happy there and gradually progress. Because we need others around us to help us, to encourage us, to remind us to follow what your position is demanding of you. And if not, if you live alone, then you're thinking, I am so advanced. See, I don't need any other association. I'm just good. And everyone else is thinking, look, he's so fixed. He's just by himself. He's just really absorbed. And within a very short time, missing in action, gone, right? Because they didn't have the proper association and the checks and balances to keep them from being subject to the perils of this material world out there. So it's very important to always be in that shelter. And so one is gradually working themselves up, and then this is to prepare us for the end of life, which is not an easy thing to actually to deal with your old age and your disease and still remain Krishna conscious, and then ultimately the time of death, the time of death, of being fixed, and not letting any of those material desires surface that will keep you bound again and make you come back again, which is the most frightening thing for a devotee. I'm not sure how it works at those last years. I see it's, I'm totally confused about it, that I guess each ashram would take care of their elderly people and help them. I'm assuming that's what happened. The renounced, you see like women ashrams in India, I guess they would just help each other, the widows and everything at the time of death to remain fixed. Sannyasis, I don't know who would take care of them. But we have, in our society, Prabhupada has allowed us to have a hospice in Vrindavan. I'm not sure if they're arranging for one in Mayapur yet. But here in America, we need to work on it. We need to work on some facility to help those who are elderly and who might not have someone, a family member to help them in this regard or a close person. So this is something that needs to be put in place. There are examples of each of these social orders that are exemplary. Like when I think of brahmachari, I think of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. If you see him, he's always, there he is, the first picture up there on the back of the temple, sitting up very straight with his hand in his bead bag, very concentrated. He was a brahmachari his whole lifetime, never even thought of sex. And he was a great scholar. He trained people in brahmachari life. He established temples and was exemplary in that position as brahmachari. Although even as a great preacher, he was looked down on because he kind of bent the rules a little. He rode in a car, which was unheard of for such a person in those days, a renounced person. But he did all these things and dressed in certain ways and maybe had some material amenities, bodily amenities to help him. But that was for his preaching mission, which he was expert at and very powerful. As a grihastha, I immediately think, and probably most of you think and right away as Bhaktivinoda Thakur, of how exemplary he was. He was transcendental his whole life. We were just hearing from Mukhya how you can make everything spiritual. And he did. His work was spiritual. There was nothing material about it at all. His family life with, 10 kids, 12 kids, totally spiritual, raising pure devotees. And, of course, every single second of his day and night, not one minute was wasted, was meant and used in spiritual life. His itinerary during the day would make you faint if you heard it. I mean, he ate at this hour, he only ate this much, and the next minute he was out the door, and this many minutes for his work and back home, and 2 minutes for drinking milk, and then another minute for, and then the rest of the night was spent studying and writing, and it's just like inconceivable. So this is an example of a perfect grihastha. We should take heed. We should not waste a second. We don't have a second to waste. He was way far beyond us in his spiritual advancement, and we got a long way to go to catch up. So we don't want to waste any time. And then the more renounced order, I think of the second picture there, Gaurdas Babaji. He was quite renounced. He was a Babaji. He took to this order of life where he was pretty much disconnected from material things. And he made himself that way so that materialists wouldn't bother him. Even for spiritual things, he didn't want to really be bothered. And he was very discreet of where he lived and what he did. He would eat out of a skull as his bowl so that he would be reminded of that death could happen at any minute. Pretty heavy. Have that in your house as your chinaware. Yeah, as a skull. And then he would wear the clothes that were discarded from the corpses that were thrown around here and there. So this is extreme. But he was very much exemplary of being someone who was renounced. No nonsense. And he would not hear anything that was not totally transcendental or not associate with anyone unless it was in connection with Krishna. And then there are persons, as described a little bit here, about person such advanced devotees that were beyond even the Vaishnava behavior. Normally we think of, you know, all these personalities are so pukka, pukka, perfect, clean in all their behavior. And this was beyond the boundaries and very much in our eyes would be questionable. Are they Vaishnavas or are they not? And these are the avadutas. Their avaduta means, this is a nice definition of an avaduta. Paramahamsa Babajis in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition do not follow any regulations of scripture, neither the worldly ones of the Varnashram system nor those meant for spiritual advancement by the process of sadhana bhakti. Thus they are known as avadutas, devotees beyond ordinary rules. And their behavior often appears eccentric to ordinary people. So, and there are, the supreme avaduta is on our altar, the first personality you come to. Who's that? Lord Nityananda. We were hearing pastimes, maybe it was yesterday, of Lord Nityananda, of, you know, being pretty crazy in some of his activities, wrestling with alligators and not behaving, actually going to knock on people's doors only dressed with the four directions, nothing else, and doing things like that. And so he's like the leader of the avadutas, but totally transcendental. It's described that if you saw Lord Nityananda coming out of an intoxication place, you know that he was just in there preaching. So he was beyond the rules and regulations. And then we can think of Sukadeva Goswami, quite an exceptional character, right? He got out of the womb after being in the womb for 16 years because he didn't want to come out in the material world, but he came out, and what did he do? He said goodbye to his father, popped out of the womb, said goodbye, and went to the forest, naked, and preached. So this is a little beyond the norm. But he was such a transcendental personality that he's been able to recite this wonderful text that we're reading today. The four Kumaras. Now they had some special Shakti. They had a scheme where, okay, I don't want to get into material life. I don't want to be a progenitor. I don't want to have anything to do with any kind of family life. So I'm just going to be a little boy. My body's going to just be look like a four-year little boy. And then I'm not going to get entangled. I'm not going to think about any of this kind of crazy family stuff. And that's what they did. They were actually able to remain as four little boys and do some great preaching and some great acts in Krishna consciousness. So, and then there was Madhvacharya. He, I think, took sannyas when he was seven or something like that. Can imagine the lamentation of his parents. And then we remember the fat python man, that he would just lay there on the street and just as something came by, he would eat it. He'd eat and eat and eat, and if no one gave him anything, then he would become skinny. And he was sometimes spit upon because he was such a strange-looking person, and he didn't care. He was totally transcendental. So this is also beyond, you know, beyond Vaishnava behavior, that one would do this. And then there's one personality, Bhamsidas Babaji. And there's a really nice book on him written by Bhakti Vikash Swami. Some research was done. And I'm going to read a little bit of his life. He was in the Vaishnava line, very advanced devotee. He was also Babaji. Didn't have to do anything with the material world. Here's a description of some of his qualities. Vamsidas always thought of the pastimes of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna and Sri Sri Gornitai. He sang songs about them and served them with great love. Although living in another world, Babaji Maharaj was not totally unaware of what was happening around him in this world. When necessary, he expressed external consciousness. For instance, sometimes he ordered his associates to make travel arrangements. But he was considered an avaduta, and his behavior was so unusual that in any culture less spiritually enlightened than that of India, he would have would almost certainly have been considered crazy. Although physically present in this world, he had little connection with it. He was about 6 feet tall and strongly built. His hair and beard were uncut, matted, and disheveled. He never took bath, and his eyes looked wild. He wore a loincloth only and nothing more. So he was a strange-looking personality. There's a picture of him on the front of here. And you would be a little scared to see him. He's a little spooky. But he was totally merged in Krishna consciousness. And amongst his activities, Prabhupada mentions him. And he mentions about this one particular point about his activities with his deities. He had some beautiful deities. Vamsi Das's whole existence was simply to be with his deities. He would talk day and night with them and was hardly aware of anything else. His deities, some kopins and a few odds and ends, were his only possessions. Vamsi Das was especially attached to his Gopal deity, who he carried everywhere in his right hand. Vamsi Das's mode of worship was simply to see his deities, live with them, and talk with them in a most intimate and informal manner, sometimes laughing and sometimes quarreling with them. He hardly spoke to anyone of this world, but would spend all day talking to his beloved deities, especially Gopal and Gornitai. So this is very exceptional. And there's many, many stories of him chastising the deities, and it's pretty amazing. And Prabhupada mentions that, yes, this personality, he was very absorbed in his deities. And he was also very, very transcendental. And this is a nice story. A girl about 7 or 8 years old daily brought a pot of Ganga water for Vamsi Das. One time she brought it during a severe storm. Babaji Maharaj told her not to go out again, but she did not listen and opened the door to leave. Just as she was about to stand on the doorstep, Vamsi Das jumped up and pulled her back inside the cottage. The next second, a thunderbolt hit that very spot where she was about to step. Many, many people did come to visit him because he was such a transcendental personality. They just wanted to do service to him, or they wanted to get his remnants. And there's so many stories about how they would hide and somehow or other just to get a little remnant of it. Many people used to bring bananas to Vamsi Das. He would ask his servant to tie the bananas up to the rafters inside the roof so they could hang and ripen. Many rats would come digging holes in the earth next to the hut and make big piles of soil in their endeavors to get those bananas. Vamsi Das never tried to prevent them. Sometimes when Vamsi Das saw a rat, he would point to it and say, "This is a thief." And then he would point at Krishna and say, "He's also a thief." So he was quite a personality. Beyond the rules and regulations, he actually smoked a hookah with some strong tobacco. So in our eyes, we would be questionable. But Prabhupada was very careful, especially when we went to Vrindavan, because there's still many of these transcendental souls. All the souls in Vrindavan are transcendental. But in our eyes and in our judgment, we might make offense. So best not to even associate with them. Prabhupada would actually discourage us from associating with these residents, but to stay within this kind of complex. It's nice here. It says, "This book introduces us to a personality so extraordinary and exalted that all we can do is offer him obeisances and beg for his mercy." So that was the attitude Prabhupada wants to have to these personalities that were beyond the rules and regulations, to respect them and to beg some mercy so that we can also at some time progress and reach some advanced stage where we can think of Krishna all the time and not have all the desires that are haunting us and keeping us from being close to Krishna. There's many enthusiastic devotees like Narada Muni who tried to go around and encourage them, push people to become brahmacharis. He did it a couple times with the sons of Daksha. Daksha got pretty fried on it because he really wanted people to devotees to go quickly to accelerate in Krishna consciousness. So Narada Muni did a lot of preaching on that side. Lord Chaitanya was a little lighter on that side. When he was in South India, there was one enthusiastic householder who was, I just want to join your movement. I want to go preach. And he left home. And then Lord Chaitanya said, no, you go back to your home, and you just stay there, be a nice householder, and preach at that level. So we have to also understand that we should be very honest in our position and preach from that level. In Gauralila, there's a very nice example of one devotee. I don't want to go over time much, but of Chota Haridas, who was also given a special type of mercy by Lord Chaitanya for a very important message, which has to do with the verse today. And that is of how we should, in our ashram that we choose, that we should be very exemplary ourselves in whatever ashram we are in. Chota Haridas was in the renounced order, and one day Bhagavan Acharya, who was the cook for Lord Chaitanya, said, "Oh, Chota Haridas, you know, he was brahmacharya, he said, please go to and beg some rice." And I understand that Madhavi, the sister of Sikimihiti, has wonderful rice. Please go there because I want to cook it for Lord Chaitanya. So he went and he begged from Sikimihiti's sister, Madhavi. This Madhavi is not a spring chicken. She was an elderly lady, and she was actually considered by Lord Chaitanya as the half of the 3.5 most intimate associates of Lord Chaitanya. There's Ramananda Roy, Sikimihiti, and Swarup Damodar, and the half is Madhavi. And so Lord Chaitanya actually considered this woman, who was elderly, as was formerly an associate of Radharani. No ordinary lady. So anyway, Chota Haridas asked for this rice, took the rice back, it was cooked. Lord Chaitanya honored the rice and said, "Wow, this rice is wonderful. Such flavor in this rice. Where did you get it, Bhagavan Acharya?" He says, "Well, I got it from begging." He said, "Who begged it?" "Chota Haridas." "Where did he beg it from?" "From Madhavi." "You mean he intimately associated with a woman in this begging process?" And he says, don't let Chota Haridas come to my door again." And all the Vaishnavas were like, "Wow, you know, he did, you know, didn't really mean to." Anyway, they didn't understand. It's hard for us to even understand because Lord Chaitanya is the most merciful, Patit Pavan. And here he's not giving this mercy. Even though they spoke to Chota Haridas and said, came back to Lord Chaitanya on his behalf and said, "Chota Haridas says that he understands, you know, he would never do that again. He's learned his lesson. He's, you know, never going to associate with a woman again, not even in dreams." And all the other devotees, also they were so frightened, they wouldn't even associate with, even think of a woman in their dreams. Because Lord Chaitanya refused. Said no. No more association for him. And even they got someone else to come, very close to Lord Chaitanya, still he would not break down. Even to the point where Junior Haridas committed suicide. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati discusses that this is to prove that, first of all, that one must stick to their ashram, must not deviate from their position. And to be an associate of Lord Chaitanya, one must follow Lord Chaitanya's instructions. If we want any advancement at all, this is a lesson that we should directly follow every instruction of Srila Prabhupada, who is a representative of Lord Chaitanya. And he also did it to show that if he hadn't done that, then the pseudo-devotees would say, "Well, look, you know, that standard is, is not being, set upon by even the leaders, so then maybe I can take advantage and I can do that activity too, and then the whole society will fall apart." So the leaders have to keep that standard and enforce that standard. So this is an instruction that we should understand, that we should stick to our ashram and be very good examples for our whole society and for the world. And our duty now is to establish this society with very strict standards and to please Srila Prabhupada. And I can see just from running a an ashram for a while, it's really hard to keep the standard high, because we always want to go below the standard just a little. So it's very, very high. And even within our movement, we can see for, I don't know if I should mention it, but the standard of not associating with the opposite sex before marriage. You know, and in the material world, men and women live together way for years before they get married. And now, even within our movement, that standard is more or less accepted. And it shouldn't be. It should be very strict. And it should not be glorified or accepted. And so we have to be very careful that all these ashrams are very much defined and followed in this movement. Any comments, questions? Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.